All right. Well, I'm supposed to start on time to keep Chris happy. Thanks for coming to this session this afternoon, and a special thanks to the dads who are on baby care right now. I know there are several who are doing that so that they're... You can't hear me? Is that better? No? Keep going. You can hear me? There we go. Okay. Well, thank you. A special thank you to the dads who are on baby duty this afternoon so that their wives can come and listen. And if you are a mom with small children here, I hope you enjoy an hour of sitting down and resting. So what we're going to do in this hour is look at five lessons that women of the Reformation can teach us. And we're going to use one woman as an example in each category, although often they all exemplify all of these. But we're just using one in each. So the first lesson we can learn from Reformation women is that a hard past does not negate present fruitfulness. The 16th century was not a pleasant time in which to live. Plague rolled around. Wars were almost constant. Food could be scarce or expensive. This led to low life expectancy and really high infant mortality. And the Reformation added religious and social upheaval to it all. But one thing we clearly see from believing women in this period is that deep trials and suffering don't cripple fruitfulness, and they can, in fact, facilitate it. And our woman who exemplifies this is Katharina Luther. She's known for her work, enabling her husband to do his seminal work of reforming. And in between reviewing Luther's writing and hosting his students and raising children, Katharina brewed beer, caught fish, butchered pigs, and read her Bible. Without her, Luther would not have been as productive or healthy or happy. And some of his pet names for her were Heart Love, Morning Star of Wittenberg, Sir Katharina, Mrs. Doctress, Your Holiness, Preacher, Dear Katie. Her work facilitated and furthered the Reformation. And looking at her work after marriage, you wouldn't guess her background. In 1499, she's born to a noble family in eastern Germany, and when she's little, her mom dies. By the time she's six, her dad decides to get remarried, and she's dropped off at a cloister school. About 3 years later, she is dropped off at a Cistercian convent for good. Imagine what this does to a young girl. Her mother dies, and for some reason, she's chosen from among her siblings to go leave her family and live with a pseudo-family. It's really common at the time, donating a child to the church, but it's serious child abuse, late medieval style. We don't know how she copes with it growing up, but what we do see in her as an adult is a deep love for children, and particularly for orphans. Together, Martin and Katharina have six children, Johannes, Elizabeth, Magdalena, Martin, Paul, and Margaret, and they adopt orphans and poor relatives, George, Andreas, Syriacus, Fabian, Elsa, and Lena Kaufman, a sibling group, Hans Polner, Martin Luther Jr., who was a nephew, Anna Strauss, Hannah van der Saal, Florian van Bora, and possibly two others. It makes a total of at least 16 children that Katie cares for, six biological, six or seven nieces and nephews, and at least four orphans. This doesn't happen in an emotional void. You can't take in a dozen children who aren't yours and love them like a mother without deep inner motivation. Part of it probably comes from her understanding of her own adoption into God's family, but part of it has to come from her own suffering and a desire to keep other children from the same grief. She knows what it's like to be bereaved and abandoned at a vulnerable age, so the hardship of her childhood prepares her to show compassion on hurting children as an adult. So this first hardship bears fruit. In the convent, as a child, Katharina is inserted into the strict order of monastic life, and the hardship here is not the order or the quiet, it's the falsehood that Katharina is immersed in. Convents are pseudo-families with pseudo-mothers and pseudo-sisters offering a pseudo-gospel. Because monasticism resisting nuns and monks in books and movies as the helpful people, the safe people to go to. But monasticism is evil, and it by definition abuses the people who are part of it. It's an anti-gospel institution. But Katharina does not realize this, of course. At the time, she's just part of the religious community there. She doesn't understand that she's suffering spiritual abuse. The convent has a considerable collection of relics that the nuns use in their religious rites, and there are prayers, worship of Mary, and the silence personal poverty, isolation, and strict hierarchy that seemed normal to any medieval European at the time because of the church's control over the population. But again, the Lord designs it for her good. What she doesn't see at the time and can't see at the time is that the convent is actually giving her a skill set that she'll use to help the man who starts the Reformation. The nuns have a lot, the convent has a lot of land around it. The nuns grow a lot of their own food. There's gardening, there's animal husbandry going on around her. She doesn't do a lot of the physical work herself, but she sees food production. She sees that a small community can be pretty self-sustaining because of a bunch of hardworking women. The convent serves as a pilgrimage destination. The nuns often house these travelers, and so Katerina sees the importance of hospitality and community. Care for the sick is also part of monastic life, and Katerina shows herself to be a good nurse later in life. And one huge advantage that nuns have over other women in this time is education. Nuns are taught how to read. So Katerina can read German, her native German, as well as Latin, which she also speaks to some extent. So this prepares her very specifically for being the wife of an author and intellectual. The convent's not just giving her practical skills. She has a habit of personal prayer pressed into her, and she later expresses thanks for this in life. So God prepares Katerina to be involved in reform before she even realizes that reform is a possibility. And by 1523, she realizes it's not just a possibility, it's a necessity. The printing press had allowed the production, mass production, of Protestant literature, especially pamphlets, which you can think about as sort of the blogs of the 16th century. And they're smuggled across Germany. They get into even convents and monasteries. They reach Katerina. She and several other nuns are converted by reading Luther's writings, and they eventually decide that they have to get out. They write Luther asking what they should do, and he says flee to Wittenberg. So the story about hiding in fish barrels is not apparently true. It should be, but it's not. So says a German Lutheran historian. The women were just on the wagon, but the 60 miles to Wittenberg would have been uncomfortable and dangerous enough. And that's because escaped nuns are a huge problem in 1523. They make the Roman Catholic Church angry. They've broken vows. And they're essentially fugitives. Even anyone helping them is subject to execution if caught. The nuns have made enemies of their families by embarrassing them and betraying them in converting. And ex-nuns are really awkward in society, too. They have little experience of interacting with men and children, and they're not very employable. They're leaving very secure, stable environments and futures for completely unpredictable ones. So they're really vulnerable socially, legally, emotionally. Luther understands this, and he helps them all find places to live and work. And Katerina's third trial is servanthood, following the bereavement and spiritual abuse. She becomes a domestic servant for two different families in Wittenberg as she adjusts to civilian life. And although Katerina does bring some practical skills from the convent with her, she's never seen how a family, let alone a Christian family, functions. And that's what she learns in these two homes. So the third trial will bear fruit. Her two mistresses seem to have been excellent homemakers. So Katerina sees how to manage money and servants, children and visitors. She sees that families aren't as predictable as monasteries, convents, and how a wife and mother deals with that. She also sees Christian marriages functioning. Imagine what an escaped nun would learn about marriage from living in your home. She has good examples that serve her well. And despite the good environments in these homes, or maybe because of the good environments in these homes, she seems to want her own home. And in her first year as a servant, just months after leaving the convent, she meets a university student, Jerome Baumgartner, and they fall in love. It's known in town that they're a couple. Jerome has to leave town later that year, and Katerina hears nothing more from him. The next year, Luther writes to him, "If you want to hold on to your Katie von Bora, hurry before she's given to someone else. She's not yet gotten over her love for you." You can imagine what Katerina is going through here, living as a servant in someone else's home with a broken heart, the Protestant leadership in town trying to figure out what's going on with the relationship. And what's going on is Jerome's family. They're wealthy, they're politically connected, and they do not want an ex-nun as a daughter-in-law. That's a definite liability. And so Jerome has to choose between his family and Katerina, and he chooses his family, marrying a wealthy younger woman. He's not the only suitor that Katerina has during this period, but he's the only one that she loved. And the abandonment must have sunk deep into her at the time since it affected her physically. Of course, you know how the story goes. She marries Dr. Luther himself in 1525 at the height of the Peasants' War. And he doesn't marry her because he loves her. he marries her, he said, to please his father and spite the Pope and the devil. Luther was a great man, but he was not an easy man. He is intense. He's moody. He's sometimes depressed. He's crass. You can see him walking around with a death sentence over his head, complaining about his bowels. Katerina brings him to his senses and cares for him. Did part of Katerina's love for him come from his faithfulness to her? I think it did. Having a father and then a suitor abandon you would make you very thankful for a faithful man. And I think that Katerina's devotion to her husband and her patience with him is in part a deep appreciation of his steadfast love for her, because, of course, he does fall in love with her. His letters show how quickly and completely she sweeps him off his feet. And for the rest of her marriage, all of her past experiences inform and power her service as a wife and mother. And there is the Black Cloisters Monastery, ironically, the monastery that housed the first Reformation family. And you can see all the gardens that she's got going there. If you look at how God set this up, looking back from Katerina's fruitfulness in marriage, providence is really clear. The training is so specific to the calling here, moving from nun to servant to reformer's wife, unknowingly gathering tools for ministry along the way. God knows what Katerina will need in order to contribute to reform, and he provides before she even realizes what her role will be. Her sort of background, with everything from rejection to physical danger to bad teaching, could have crippled Katerina emotionally, spiritually, relationally. It didn't. She not only understood God's providence, she also had a theology of suffering and a strong sense that the work in front of her was important. Luther, and thus the church, needed her. That allowed her to put her past in a biblical perspective and also put her past to use. Doesn't mean that she never struggled with the hardships that she went through. We don't know what she thought about as she washed sheets and dug up vegetables. But she must have grieved over her lost childhood as she raised her own children. The broken engagement left questions for a time. But these things didn't stunt her. God enabled her to use these hard lessons and be a blessing to his church. Most of us here haven't suffered like this. Some of us have suffered more in different ways. So I hope this is more of an encouragement than a lesson. Don't let past hardships choke out service to Christ and his church today. The second thing we can learn from these women is what biblical womanhood looks like. Biblical definitions of womanhood and femininity are often different than ours. Excelling as a woman doesn't mean excelling in a man's role or just applauding the men as they excel. It means pursuing excellence at your particular calling as a woman within biblical boundaries, regardless of traditional roles. Because tradition doesn't have legitimate weight in defining masculine and feminine. Tradition can get it wrong. The Bible never does. So we have to conform our standard of womanhood to the Bible's standard, believing God's testimony of femininity above our culture's distortions and above our reactions to those distortions. We don't think of the 16th century as a time when people had to sort out gender and identity roles, but Roman Catholicism actually had very strong ideas about women and what they should be doing. For example, lactating nuns and celibate wives were both considered holy. That's a problem. It's icky and it's a problem. And because Roman Catholic teaching fell apart under a scriptural examination, the Protestant church had to deal with the fallout. So runaway nuns, priests' wives, reveal real issues of gender and identity confronting the early Protestant church. And it turned to scripture for guidance. What did it see there? It saw Miriam, the prophetess, leading the Israelite women. It saw Jael, the stay-at-home mom, assassinating an enemy general. It saw Abigail, the woman in a difficult marriage, using her wealth to provide for David. It saw Dorcas, the older woman, devoting herself to care for the poor. And Priscilla, the well-taught wife, helping Paul with his teaching ministry. So clearly, biblical womanhood was not limited to convent walls or Roman Catholic nurseries, nor was it limited to raising Protestant babies and reading your Bible at home. Biblical womanhood was and is using your gifts to serve the church in ways in which you can best facilitate its growth and health according to biblical patterns. And just like in Proverbs 31, biblical femininity is often expressed in active service. The woman who we'll focus on this afternoon as our example of this is Katerina Zell. And it's debated whether this is actually Katerina Zell. Some people say it's Martin Bucer's wife, but this would have been roughly what she looked like. She's born in 1497 in Strasbourg, and she's well-educated as a child. She develops a deep religious zeal while she's young, but she always feels that her works and her penance aren't enough to buy her way into heaven. She struggles with assurance of salvation. In her late teens, Matthew Zell, one of the lesser-known reformers, arrives in town, preaching Christ to the city. Katerina hears from the pulpit that Christ's death paid the penalty for her sins, and that salvation is a free gift, and her search for spiritual security dies with an understanding of Christ's completed work. Pastor and parishioner Mary, just a few months after the Luthers, December 3rd, 1525. There's a 20-year age gap between bride and groom, so you can imagine the sorts of comments that the Roman Catholics are making. It's one of the first Protestant marriages after the Luthers, and it's a bold step for husband and wife as it breaks canon law and defies Rome, but it's a step that the Lord blesses. Katerina's education and growing understanding of the Bible enable her to defend truth in public as well as in private. Sometimes it seems as though she outdoes her husband in this. Martin Bucer says that she's a trifle imperious, but he also admits that she is God-fearing and courageous as a hero. Her first published work is a defense of clerical marriage, Priests and Pastors Getting Wives. Her work not only refutes accusations about her own marriage, but it also helps people rethink the issue. She goes back to the Bible, showing that clerical celibacy has no biblical grounds. And the work also defends her right as a layperson and as a woman to read scripture and publicly present arguments from it. And the writing makes her known through Europe. There is a title page from it. Through her life, Katerina keeps up correspondence with many intellectuals, including Erasmus and Calvin, discussing issues and principles. We know from these letters that she's well-read because she quotes a range of theologians from Augustine to Savonarola to Melanchthon. Between 1526 and 1533, Katerina gives birth to two babies. Both of the babies die in infancy. Matthew seems to cope better, but Katerina especially struggles. She wonders if the deaths are a chastisement from God and really takes time to work through the grief. Though it is a deep valley for her, the loss, the double loss, doesn't seem to slow her service to others or her care for the church. She continues her mercy ministry, which she had throughout her life. She visits people with leprosy, syphilis, and the plague. Occasionally, she has to fight city magistrates to gain access to these people because they don't want the disease to spread. But she does it, and she wins. In 1548, Zell dies. And after his death, Strasbourg really changes its theological direction. About 10 years after his death, Katerina becomes involved in her most public and painful controversy. When her husband was alive, they had a student, Rabbis, live in their home as an intern, and he becomes Zell's successor and a really popular preacher in town. But despite of his training, he starts attacking Reformed customs from the pulpit, urging high Lutheranism. Now, Katerina is not going to tolerate a former student teaching bad theology, especially in her husband's pulpit, and she writes against Rabbis. Rabbis answers her, and the letters move from theological political issues to public personal attacks on Katerina, whom he calls disturber of the peace of the church. She replies in a letter to the whole city, "Do you call this disturbing the peace? That instead of spending my time in frivolous amusements, I have visited the plague-infested and carried out the dead? I visited those in prison and under sentence of death. Often for 3 days and nights I've neither eaten or slept. I've never mounted the pulpit, but I've done more than any minister in visiting. Is this disturbing the peace of the church? You young fellows tread on the graves of the first fathers of this church in Strasbourg and punish all who disagree with you." It's a time that causes her a lot of sorrow. And by 1558, her study of the scriptures produces a commentary on Psalms 51, 130, and the Lord's Prayer. It's more meditative than her other writings and shows an author spiritually developed by means of grace and sorrow. And it's her last published work. The date of her death is unknown. She is living in March 1562, because we know that because a letter she wrote that day survives, saying that she is half dead with her long sickness. And certainly by the end of that year, she's in glory. Historians today call her a lay reformer, but she only did what every Christian should, used her gifts for gospel change in her own sphere, whatever way is possible. Bucer remarked, "Her zeal is incredible for Christ's lowliest and afflicted. She knows and searches the mysteries of Christ." Submission did not equal passivity, but creative, active, sacrificial service that had the support of her husband, the recognition of the community, and the blessing of the Lord. Biblically channeled zeal resulted in a strong woman who was free to exercise her gifts. But notice that the roles of author and public figure were not her goals. They simply came as she strove to serve her family and the church. She wasn't responding to a call for more women in public theological dialogue or publishing. Public roles outside the home are not things that Protestant women in this era fought for. They came to fill them because they were excelling in the home and had the thoughtfulness, theological background, energy, and opportunity to do more when there was a need. And public roles were not filled at the cost of private roles, the primary callings of caring for family. Husband and children weren't sacrificed for career or personal fulfillment. His real ministry is neither of those, is it? And there was contentment when God limited these women to private domestic roles, but there was also great fruitfulness and freedom here. Reformation-era believers could answer issues of bad Catholic teaching on gender roles, not because they were reacting to it, as we so often react to feminism, but because they were living out the principles that they found in Scripture. Protestant orthodoxy at the time was, in general, very comfortable with this wide range of activities that these women engaged in. Reformation wives and male theologians would have been appalled by a woman preaching or leading worship, but they're happy to have women learning, writing, even leading armies, because of the Bible's principle of believers using their gifts within inspired boundaries. The big question regarding gender roles in the church is not how much are women allowed to do, but how can women use their gifts to serve Jesus? And Jesus gives us very clear guidelines in his word. And Reformation women give us very solid examples in this area as we try and learn what womanhood can actually be based not on our own feelings or tradition or desires, but on unchanging biblical principles in a world that's very confused on this subject. The third lesson is what a home is. For many Reformation women, childhood homes were distant places. They were donated to convents as children, and so home was an early childhood memory with bitter associations. Others of these women came from very wealthy backgrounds, where home was a place to display your money and power. But the Reformation changed that. In the Reformation, home became headquarters for a family's fruitfulness. Our culture treats our homes as private places where we retreat, places of personal consumption and relaxation. And homes ought to be places where we can rest and unwind when we need it. But Christians in the 16th century studied the scriptures and saw examples like the Proverbs 31 woman and Lydia and others who used their homes as tools, as bases for Christian service. These women ran their households for maximum fruitfulness, and this is actually an expression of womanhood that Scripture commands. In 1 Timothy 5:14, Paul tells younger women, among other things, to be home managers, and the Greek term gives the idea of a ruler, someone who excels in running a home because she's taken able charge of domestic affairs. And we see this sort of thing in Europe as Protestantism takes hold, women running efficient, fruitful homes to support their husbands and help the church. And Anna Bullinger is our Reformation woman who models this. We don't have an image of her, but that's the church where her husband pastored. She's born around 1504, and she's 8 when her father dies in battle. Her mother donates her to a convent at Zurich, and eventually she takes holy orders. But while she lives as a nun, Zwingli's preaching changes the town and eventually the convent. Heinrich Bullinger is sent to preach to the nuns. Officially, it was to teach them Latin, but he's teaching them the gospel. He meets Anna, they fall in love, and around the time the convent closes, they marry on August 1529. Bullinger ends up with a call to serve as a pastor here, and he accepts. It's a great honor, but it comes with great responsibility, not just for the preacher, but also for his wife. And a busy husband is just one aspect of her calling, and Anna's definitely busier than her husband. Babies arrive almost yearly until there are 11 children in the home. Bullinger's father and mother live in the home until they die. The couple takes in Zwingli's widowed wife and children, caring for them as their own family. And Bullinger also has the habit of having interns or other gifted students live in the house. It's really common for Protestant pastors at this time. So Anna's family becomes very large, often with more than 20 people living in her home. She must have been good with money because she feeds and clothes everyone on a very ordinary salary. But it's hard. And we have hints of her difficulty in a letter that Bullinger writes to his oldest son, who is a university student. "Your mother makes big eyes when you speak of needing another pair of shoes for the winter. It's hardly 15 weeks since you left us, and you took 3 pairs with you." The large family is not the only thing that Anna has on her plate. Her home is a home to Protestant refugees from all over Europe. They come from Italy, starting in 1542. That's the year that she really starts this ministry. They come from England when Bloody Mary takes the throne, from Switzerland. And Anna sets the example of hospitality for the whole city. Her visitors aren't limited to those fleeing persecution, though. Her husband's talents and position bring theologians who want to talk. Mary Beakey often says, they're paid to talk for a living. Of course they're going to talk. So the Bullinger home welcomes men who want to talk. Calvin and Farrell from Geneva. Bucer and Capita from Strasbourg. Philippe de Mornay from France. The Bullinger home welcomes all of them. Anna also cares for the needy in Zurich. She's always running out to bring food to poor people, visit the sick in the congregation, bring clothes to orphans. People know this. They drop things off at her house and let her distribute them as she sees fit. People start calling her the Zurich Mother. In 1564, the Bullinger contracts the plague. Anna nurses him so that he recovers, but she catches it herself and dies shortly after. Now, Anna's work must have seemed like drudgery at times. You housewives will know what this looks like to some extent, just endless meals and laundry and morning sickness. But when we see it as a whole and the fruit that it bore, it's remarkable. Anna sheltered and fed hundreds every year. She raised many children, cared for her mother and her in-laws as they died, allowed young men to prepare for future ministry, and enabled her husband to further the gospel cause in Zurich and beyond. Bullinger's best-selling book, Christian Matrimony, reflects the happy marriage pattern that he and Anna had, and that pattern spread through Europe. Anna became the Protestant standard for many decades. She lived out the pattern we see in Scripture of doing good to everyone, especially the household of faith, caring for poor orphan and widow, welcoming a stranger, bringing up children, honoring father and mother, and loving a husband. It's very typical of Protestant women in this era. They saw their homes as bases for ministry. Their work was never done. They never checked everything off and headed for the spa. So they did occasionally take time off, usually at a husband's insistence. But what we see again and again in the Reformation is God taking ordinary obedience, just simple, unglamorous, hard work like this, and using it to transform a culture. Clear that Anna's work was a blessing to the people she served directly. But in this era, what Anna and other Protestant women did was radical. Just marrying a pastor was a public denunciation of monasticism, and then quietly raising Protestant children and opening your home to the Protestant church added insult to injury. It directly challenged the Roman Catholic Church's teaching on marriage and much more. Not only were these women living quiet, fruitful lives, but God used their obedience to complete a shift in European culture. Think about how convents and monasteries functioned before the Reformation. They served as hospitals, basic education facilities, hostels, and places of personal devotion. Believing housewives proved that they could read, pray, garden, care for the sick, host travelers, and foster an intellectual climate just as well as monks and nuns had for centuries. Protestant housewives did a lot to make monasticism socially obsolete. As their lives conformed to a biblical pattern, they showed that society could function just fine without the Roman Catholic institutions that had been propping it up. And though their work wasn't always visible, Protestant housewives attacked Catholic presuppositions by that very domestic work. Notice that these women didn't form a committee and strategize on how to take up monasticism. They just obeyed. They worked hard and were self-disciplined, and God used that feminine obedience to do his own work. So we really need to be thinking of how to use our homes as basis for ministry today. This would include hospitality, teaching, prayer, reading, learning, and more. How might God use that in a culture where homes are falling apart? The fourth lesson these women have left us is what biblical Catholicity looks like. For confessional believers, the word Catholicity is often a synonym for ecumenism and can be associated with liberalism, but the two are different. Ecumenism is promoting unity between existing denominations, watering down doctrine till everyone can swallow it, while Catholicity is a positive recognition that Christ's church is universal with different local expressions. Catholicity is a love for all who confess Christ and live as Christians, regardless of their denominational or cultural background. Ecumenism tries to create a homogeneous church. Catholicity seeks to love the church universal while accepting legitimate distinctions of time, place, and creed, even creed. In the first generation of Reformed believers, Catholicity was part of survival not just for the Protestant church as it faced Rome and schism, but also for the spiritual health of individual believers. So our Reformation woman who exemplifies this is Catherine Willoughby. She is born in 1519 in England to a wealthy noble couple. By the time she's 14, she's married to Henry VIII's friend, Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, who had planned to marry her off to one of his sons, but the son dies, and so he marries her himself to keep the money in the family. He's a nominal Protestant, and Catherine is still Roman Catholic, as she was raised. As the Duchess of Suffolk, Catherine is brought into the inner circle of the royal court. She and her husband host the king. She receives personal gifts from him, and she's very influential at court socially and later politically. And the couple have two sons. There's a picture of one of her residences is still up. A couple of them have been destroyed. So during the 1540s, Catherine becomes lady-in-waiting to the Protestant queen, Henry VIII's last wife, I believe, and has increased access to Protestant literature and theologians. And sometime in this period, it seems that she's converted. In 1545, Brandon dies, leaving Catherine a widow with two sons. She's in her mid-20s and one of the wealthiest women in England. Her husband left her a lot of debt, but she has enough money to pay it off. By the following year, she's clearly in the evangelical camp, helping distribute banned theological works and advocating for the use of Tyndale's vernacular New Testament. It's risky at the time since Henry VIII is a tyrant. She becomes increasingly reformed in her convictions. 2 years after the Duke dies, Henry VIII dies too, leaving England to his truly Protestant son, Edward VI. So the deaths of the Duke and the King really changed Catherine's life. Because of these deaths, Catherine has the time, the cash, the freedom, and the political connections to facilitate the English Reformation. And that's what she does. Her encouragement and deep pockets help shape a new Protestant culture. What did that look like? Well, in 1550, she had started helping Protestant refugees from Europe and befriended John Fox. The year she loses both her children, so the second woman to lose both her children, in 1551, she hires Hugh Latimer as her chaplain. Catherine uses Latimer not just for her own growth, but also to shape her neighbors' and servants' theology. She has him preach as often as possible to different groups. She actually can put a lot of pressure on friends to come and listen to Latimer and bring their servants and bring their kids. And because of her patronage, Latimer's sermons still survive. She has them published, which is why we have them today. She funds other Protestant publications too, sermons and devotional material, spreading Reformed thought through England. She has control over her jurisdiction, a whole bunch of land, and she works with a bishop there to give Protestant positions, pastoral positions, to a lot of Protestant ministers, really promoting evangelical thought in the area. And in her land, she abolishes holy days, saints' images, and pilgrimages. She finds Protestants to teach in the parish schools, and she also sets up grammar schools. Like most Protestants, she's very concerned about education, and she makes sure that Reformed ideas are passed on to the next generation. Though it is still Protestant, England is under an Act of Parliament issued under Henry VIII forbidding lower classes and women to read the Bible. Catherine works with other aristocrats to have this repealed, and it is early on in Edward's rule. She financially supports Protestant professors at Cambridge, particularly Martin Bucer. He taught her boys before they died, and she actually cares for Bucer while he is dying. But the contribution I want to focus on this afternoon, the biggest lesson she leaves us, is her support of the continental refugees. Because Edward VI is Protestant, England is a safe place for believers, and thousands of Protestants are fleeing from the continent to English cities, particularly London, where one of Catherine's homes is. And these Christians are coming from France, Spain, Italy, Germany, Poland, and the Netherlands, anywhere the Roman Catholics are trying to stamp out Reformation. At this point, all legal churches in England belong to the Church of England. Okay, it's a crime to pastor or support anything else. But when the number of refugees in London reaches into the thousands in 1550, Catherine uses her political connections and resources to obtain a charter that allows them to establish a recognized church. They're the only congregations in England legally allowed to exist outside the Church of England. The charter grants them freedom to use their own rites and ceremonies, even though they're different from English ones. Now, this is just 1 year after the Act of Uniformity is passed under Edward, and so this exception giving these refugees this freedom is really remarkable, and it shows Catherine's influence and determination. Catherine never leaves the Church of England herself. She moves from conservative Catholicism to evangelical Reformed theology, all within the state church. Her commitment to its health and growth do not change. But just because she's personally loyal to the Church of England, this doesn't keep her from a latitude in her acceptance of other believers' ecclesiology. When these refugees arrive, Catherine works to make room for them in English religious society. She works to facilitate the spiritual good of other Christians who do not believe exactly as she does. Now, notice some things about this evangelical Catholicity. First, it's not a toleration of error. Catherine has little time for people who twist or ignore or attack scripture, and everyone in England knows it. From very early on in her marriage, she was a public opponent of Roman Catholic bishops. One of them she just routinely embarrassed in public. She had a dog who she apparently named after him and would dress it up in a little purple robe. And she worked to have this man removed from his office, and he is actually imprisoned under Edward. She also has little time for people within a confessional stream who don't hold to it or who are lax. So this is not a flippant approach to truth or to the church. And second, this Catholicity does not flow out of ignorance. Catherine knows what she believes and why she believes it. She's promoting Reformed thought in her patronage, specifically Reformed evangelical thought. She has Hugh Latimer teaching her. She works personally to correct unbiblical thought in herself, her family, her servants, and her tenants. She knows what the differences are between herself, her denomination, and the people whom she supports outside of it. So she's not acting out of a blissful unawareness that makes her happy with anything. And third, this Catholicity is not liberal ecumenism. Catherine doesn't suggest that these Protestants in the Church of England emerge to form some sort of international coalition. There's a distinctness between the Church of England and the congregations outside of it that is clear, and that Catherine and the other believers are comfortable with. They realize that there will be differences on secondary issues, as well as differences in expressions of primary issues because of cultural and creedal differences. Catherine doesn't pressure the refugees to join the English state church. They're going to be in England temporarily. They know this. And she puts pressure on the English government to make allowances for them. Catherine realizes that these refugees have a form of worship flowing out of different theological texts and different cultural contexts. And to alter the worship would be asking them to change their polity and ignore their culture. Because the refugees are biblically orthodox in their beliefs, there's nothing heretical going on here, so there's no reason for Catherine to oppose them. And she can actually make concessions for them, even though she doesn't believe the same things. She's willing that they worship in their distinct, culturally shaped way as they strive to live out their confessional understanding of Scripture. In 1553, Catherine marries a second time to a man named Richard Bertie. He's a strong believer, but the marriage shocks everybody because he's one of her servants, and it's just not done, especially for a high-ranking British woman. During this marriage, Catherine's faith is tested by persecution under Edward's sister, Bloody Mary, who is a staunch Roman Catholic and tries to reverse a lot of the work that had been done under Edward VI. So the bishop that Catherine had worked to get in prison is actually let out and put in charge. So she's forced to flee England. She's pregnant when she escapes. And she and her husband live as refugees on the continent. They first go to Germany. A Lutheran duke sort of chases them out. They end up eventually in Poland, where Jan Laski welcomes them. And after years of wandering around, the family is back in England in 1559 because Elizabeth I is on the throne and it's safe to return. She spends the last years of her life supporting the reconstruction of English Protestantism. Once again, she funds Protestant publication and preaching. She hires reformers like Miles Coverdale. She patronizes Protestant artists. She gives away Bibles, and she puts pressure on Elizabeth's government to make the Church of England more biblical. Because of her rank, she controls a parish inside London that's not part of the established church, and it becomes a seedbed for Puritan preachers right there in the capital. She supports all Protestants, including dissenters and other Christians outside the Church of England, and intercedes for ministers who preach without a government license and are put on trial for that. Having been fruitful when free and faithful under persecution, she dies after a long illness on September 19, 1580. Latimer's servant remarked that for 35 years, she'd been the mainstay of preachers, a comfort to martyrs, and God's instrument for the spread of the gospel. So Catherine's Catholicity, her universal love for all who name the name of Christ and live out of that profession, is a strong feature of her service. And it's actually a very common feature for believing women in this period. We heard a little bit of that from Ian last night. And it's interesting that the more these women knew what they believed, the more convinced they were of biblical truth, the more they were able to interact with believers from other backgrounds without biblical compromise on the one hand and without feeling threatened on the other. These women were able to be flexible within biblical bounds to accommodate and serve other Christians. They were willing to make concessions where possible to other sheep while being absolutely intolerant of wolves in sheep's clothing. Public attacks on false teachers and thoughtful care for other Christians are actually two sides of the Catholicity coin. Often it was the women who were most Catholic in the true sense who spoke up most strongly against Roman Catholicism. And that should make sense because it's just an outflow of love for Jesus, right? Love for the brethren and hatred of false teaching. Faithfulness to Christ means personal and ecclesiastical adherence to a biblical confession, knowing it, understanding it, committing to it, but being even more committed to the church universal. This sort of Catholicity feeds a love for other Christians and is easy to love because it doesn't force its own culture or particular ecclesiology on other faithful Christians outside our own denomination. It's humility, isn't it? It's an expression of humility. We realize that we don't have a stranglehold on truth, and so we can admit that and hold to a biblical confession strongly while respecting other believers who do the same. We recognize that we're each striving to be faithful as we can, because it pleases the Lord. And Reformation women give us good examples of what this looks like in real life. One historian says, they believed in a practical Christianity that demonstrated itself not through ceremonies and sacerdotalism, but rather through everyday Christian living, including charity to other Protestants. The last thing I want to look at today is the lives of these women showing God's faithfulness. And I wanted to look at three women here, but I'm not sure we have time for that. So we're going to look at the third in a short line of French Protestants. Mother, daughter, and granddaughter were all part of the French royal family. All of them experienced intimidation, isolation, difficult marriages, and deep grief. Two of them suffered from chronic health problems. But since God was for them, they persevered, even though humanly speaking it looked like everything was against them and they wouldn't be able to. So I'll briefly summarize the grandma and the mom, and then we'll look at the daughters. So the grandmother was sister of the French king, Francis I, and she's converted as an adult. Her brother increasingly turns against Protestantism. During that time, John Calvin has to flee France, and Marguerite de Navarre is her name, and she intercedes for Huguenots repeatedly. She marries a man who's the King of Navarre, which is a small country that doesn't exist anymore in between France and Spain, and makes a safe haven for Protestants. Her daughter is taken away. She's born and raised by the French king so that she doesn't become Protestant too. Eventually, after marrying her off to a Roman Catholic duke, the French king allows her to go home and live with her mother, and she's converted. And she marries a second time, has two children, Henri and Catherine. She has actually five children, but three of them die, and only two live to adulthood. So Catherine is the one I would like to look at with you this afternoon. She is the daughter of Jean d'Albret, and she's a later Reformation woman, almost post-Reformation, second generation. She's born in 1559. Her father is a really horrible man. Thankfully, he dies when she's a baby. And her mother is left with entire charge of her upbringing. Her mother is wonderful, a devoted Protestant, a difficult woman to get along with in life in many ways, but she is very faithful, very conscientious of her duty. So she teaches her daughter well, Catherine's also very close to her brother Henri, who's in line for the French throne. She grows up in the middle of really horrible family and national conflict. The French wars of religion are going on, so France is having a major civil war, series of them, between the Huguenots and the Roman Catholics. But her mother tries to protect her from this and make sure she's well-educated. She hires Theodore Beza to be her daughter's teacher. And Catherine learns drawing, music, math, philosophy, theology, and many languages. She's multilingual. And she comes to faith as a child. That's the palace where she grew up in as a child. In 1573, her mom, Jeanne d'Albret, has to negotiate a marriage contract for her brother Henri to the daughter of the French king. And so they go to Paris. Catherine is under huge pressure to cave to the decadence and unbelief there, but she doesn't. Jeanne writes to a friend, "You cannot imagine how my daughter shines in this company. Everyone assails her about her religion, and she stands up to them all." The mother knew from experience what kind of determination it took to do this. Days later, Jeanne, who struggled with health her whole life, poor health, is under huge internal pressure. She's really afraid of what is going to happen because of the marriage between her son and the French princess. And her body just gives out. She dies a few days after, leaving Catherine a last message through a governess. She urges her daughter to stand firm and constant in God's service despite her extreme youth, and insists that her daughter, the princess, be constantly instructed in the fear of God and knowledge of the gospel. And she gives Catherine's guardianship over to Catherine's brother, Henri. Catherine is just 13 years old, and her mother's death is the beginning of lifelong persecution. Her mother's wishes are ignored. The French king and his mother take over Catherine's guardianship. Henri and Catherine are kept in Paris and live during the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. It was the Roman Catholic attempt to wipe out Protestantism in France, and thousands of Protestants are murdered, including some of Catherine's own servants. Henri is forced to recant Protestantism on behalf of his sister as well as himself, and he does it, and Catherine develops depression. Eventually, Henri is allowed to go back to rule Navarre, which is limping along on its own. When he gets there, he starts pushing for his sister's release. It's resisted for years, but she eventually arrives back home at the age of 16. And she comes home having been orphaned, seen her church massacred, and lived through significant personal persecution during her years in Paris. She gets back to Navarre here and renounces Roman Catholicism, making public profession of the Protestant faith with her brother. By the age of 17, Catherine is acting as regent for Henri, who has to leave Navarre to fight for the French throne. So Catherine manages troops and money and international political connections. Through her life, Catherine suffers from migraines, like her mother. The headaches are sometimes debilitating. The worst one, she says, lasts for 14 months. Somehow she manages to run Navarre despite this affliction. She also has an inherited disability, one leg shorter than the other, which gives her a limp through her life. In 1589, Henri becomes king of France. He has to convert to Catholicism in order to do this. He gives up Protestantism, he said, because Paris is worth a mass. But Catherine is devastated by his unbelief and writes, "I'm so distressed, I cannot express it adequately." She's also under pressure to convert herself. Henri puts Catherine under sustained intimidation to renounce Protestantism, but she remains a devout Calvinist, despite pressures from her brother to follow his lead in abandoning their mother's faith. She's still regent of Navarre, since her brother's now running France, and she's still very close to Henri. She still loves him very much, despite his conversion. In 1590, we do see a change in her identity, though. Before this point, she always signed her letters Catherine de Navarre, Catherine of Navarre. And that fall, she simply becomes Catherine for the rest of her life. Not only firm in her own faith, Catherine intercedes for other persecuted Protestants, opening her apartments in Paris as a meeting place for them. So that's the palace, the Tuileries Palace that she lived in Paris. Because of her high position, she becomes the target of Roman Catholic attacks. They don't like that she's so high profile and doing these things. She's verbally abused from Catholic pulpits. She's lied about in the press, and there are even mobs that are threatening her physical safety. She's really feeling the heat. And Henri, who is trying to keep the country from collapsing into civil war again, doesn't actually stop what she's doing, but he does keep urging her conversion very strongly. Catherine's letters to Henri are full of sisterly affection. She is a very, very loving person. But Henri uses his sister in a matrimonial chess game to cement an alliance with a powerful Roman Catholic family. Catherine had fallen in love with a cousin, Charles, but in 1592, Henri discovers that they've signed a secret marriage contract. Charles is arrested, and Catherine is put under house arrest. Henri tells her she needs to marry Henri de Lorraine, who is a staunch Roman Catholic. Sickness and stress turn Catherine to writing poetry, like her grandmother did. And the first sonnet is a heart cry to God in the middle of deep trial. With your eye of pity, look on my labor. Give some relief from these mortal pains, or, if it pleases you, Lord, that I suffer them, strengthen my heart against all these attacks. Let the cries, the tears, the sighs which my soul brings forth in her grief increase the flame which your zeal kindles within me. Pressure to marry continues, and sister stands up to brother for years until 1597, when she finally agrees to the marriage. What she won't agree to is Roman Catholicism. She knows that the king does have the right to choose her husband, but she will not acknowledge his right to choose her religion. And there is no limit to her resistance. Henri voices his frustration and writes, "My sister is in the same bad mood, stubborn, which is an unbearable affliction to me. That's why I'm hurrying as much as I can to get her married." In 1598, Catherine makes a significant impact on French religious life as a delegate in the negotiations surrounding the Edict of Nantes, which makes Protestantism legal in France. Henri gives her the job, I don't know why he gives her the job, of persuading the cardinals and bishops that the edict would serve their best interests. It's a huge assignment, and one Protestant contemporary notes, "She will need to exercise her command of the arts of persuasion to the utmost. No woman has ever undertaken a more difficult task." After many dinners and meetings, Catherine succeeds. During the negotiations, Henri lessens the pressure on his sister to convert in order to get Huguenot support for the edict, which is pushed through. And until for more than 100 years, French Protestantism is relatively safe. Months after the edict is signed, Catherine marries the Roman Catholic Duke de Lorraine. The Duke works with Henry to isolate Catherine, dismissing her Protestant ladies in waiting after the wedding. And Catherine, who's recovering from a serious fever, is devastated. She writes, "A blow so cruel and hard to believe. I cannot imagine that after obeying you and taking a husband of the other religion, you would do such a cruel thing. Have pity on a little sister. I can bear everything else, but this reduces me to despair." She gets a few maids back, but her Huguenot ministers are replaced by priests who work hard to convert her. In the summer of 1599, Catherine, who is now 40 years old, suffers a miscarriage. She's aware that the likelihood of having a child at this age, especially with her health concerns, is slim, but she desperately wants a baby, and she writes Theodore Beza asking for prayer. It's interesting, in her letters, you see them becoming less and less political and more to pastors who will be able to give her counsel and comfort. Henri works with Catherine's in-laws to convert her, but with no effect. He writes, "We've not been able to defeat my sister with all our efforts and means. I've spared neither advice, nor persuasion, nor the authority I have over her." The marriage, as you can imagine, is complicated and hard. And these difficult relationships, the isolation, the lack of fellowship, poor health, and the grief of infertility combine to make life unwelcome. Catherine writes, "I swear before God, I wish for death 1,000 times a day." Early in 1604, Catherine thinks she's expecting again, but she also has tuberculosis, so she refuses medical treatment for the TB in case it hurts the baby. But the growth is actually an abdominal tumor that ends her life on February 13th. She never realizes what's happening, and she dies begging the doctors to save the baby's life. Henri does not attend her funeral, and her body is buried beside her mother's. You can see that's a picture of her probably when she's living in the French court. You can see the wealth there. And then That is just a few years later, just before she dies. You can see how the sufferings have really aged her. It's a sad story, isn't it? This kind of suffering is unusual, and grandmother, mother, and daughters all labor under it for their lifetimes. But it is more than sad. It is really incredible. You don't have three generations of women standing up to the power of French kings and Rome just because. It's not coincidence or circumstance or even character. This sort of sacrificial faithfulness is supernatural. God is faithful to these women as individuals and as a family and enables them to stand up under the suffering. And they don't just stand up under the suffering. They're incredibly fruitful through it all. These women are a poignant picture of God's faithfulness to his people. And all of these women are sort of a Romans 12:1 exhibit, aren't they? As Ian said last night, they are living out worship. They show us what it can look like to be a living sacrifice. And they point us to the God who is the same God today and who still takes men and women and makes worshipers out of them. So let's pray that God would make us fruitful too. Thank you.